Chapter 5. Hot Zone. It's about 3 in the morning, and we're both deeply asleep when the red telephone rings. It's not a flashy electronic device with a scrambler. Quite the opposite. It's a 1950s GPO-issue telephone, which is to say it's made out of Bakelite on a pressed steel base, has a rotary dial, and the ringer is a fucking church bell, loud enough to wake the dead. It is connected via a Victorian-era twisted pair line to an electromechanical Strowger exchange in the Dancy House basement, all clicking relays and buzzing motors, guaranteed immune to EMP and other civilization-ending disasters. During the big Mexico City earthquake in the 1980s, a 12-story concrete office building collapsed on the Strowger unit in its basement. The damn thing kept working under the rubble for nearly 2 weeks until its lead-acid batteries ran down. The reason we have this archaic monstrosity in the house is that if someone in ops needs to declare a code blue emergency, the only way to stop it from ringing is to hit it very hard with a sledgehammer. Even popping a nuke over London might not be enough to stop it ringing. Both Mo and I are on the list, under different headings. She's Agent Candid, and I'm, well, among my other duties, we're big on matrix management here, I'm there as personal assistant and understudy to Angleton, the Eater of Souls. Anyway, the phone rings. At the first bell, I awaken with a shudder, but am confused and wonder if it's one of those curious auditory hallucinations sent to torment the somnolent by disturbing a good night's sleep with phantom dispatches from the home delivery network. But with the second ring, it's the traditional British ring-ring, not the long, drawn-out American ring. I'm halfway out of bed before I realise what's happening, and by the third ring, I'm at the bottom of the stairs, swearing and fumbling for the receiver, as Mo clatters around behind me, bare-ass naked and clutching her violin case. "Howard speaking," I say, forcing the words through a sleep-congested larynx. "Control here. This is a code blue call for Agent Candid." Oh, fuck. I look round, see Mo looming over me with sleep-disordered hair, violin case in hand. "It's for you," I say, and pass her the phone. We squeeze past each other and I go back up the hall staircase, shivering in the late-night chill as she takes the call. "Candid here," she says. I go back to the bedroom and pull her go-bag from the closet. What else? Ah, yes. There's a spare toilet bag packed and ready to go in the bathroom. I fetch that, too, and carry it downstairs. She's still on the phone, listening intently, as I squeeze past her to the kitchen, plant the bags, then start prepping the coffee maker. Either she'll have time for a mug before they pick her up, or I can use it in a few hours' time. It all depends what kind of job it is. This happens every month or two. Usually she's gone for a couple of days, sometimes only for a few hours. But on one notable occasion she disappeared for nearly a month. It's not her they need so much as her bone-white violin and its human attendant. I hate that fucking thing. It's an Eric Zahn original, one of a double handful fabricated in Weimar, Germany. You can't get the materials to make any more of them, and you wouldn't want to unless you were a particularly macabre serial killer. The reason the organization needs it is summed up in this now-tattered sticker Mo added to the case several years ago. "This machine kills demons." But to do that, it needs a violinist. And she's very proficient. Too proficient. If she was less good at it, they'd take the thing away from her and give it to some other poor bastard who I wasn't married to. Presently, I hear the clatter of her hanging up. "Got time for coffee?" I ask as her footsteps come closer. "I think so," she says, and I flick the switch on the filter machine. "They've booked me onto a 6 o'clock flight out of London City, but there's plenty of time. Hand luggage only." It's dark in the kitchen, and she's as pale as a ghost in the twilight glow of the LEDs on the microwave oven. "Speaking of which..." "I got your bag," I say, as the coffee begins to burble and spit. "Oh, Bob." She puts the violin case down on the table, then comes towards me. We embrace awkwardly. She rests her chin on my shoulder. There's an unpleasant tension in the back of her neck. "I'd better get dressed soon." She makes no move to pull away. "Can you say where you're going? Or how long you'll be?" "No, except it's outside the Schengen area, meaning I need a passport, and no, but probably not more than 2 nights. Maybe less. If you need to know more, you can yell at Danny White or someone else in OpExec. That tears it. OpExec didn't deal with trivial stuff, paranormal parking tickets and the like. If she's working for them on this assignment, then she's probably going to come home with her heart, if not her sanity, in pieces. Assuming she does come home. But that's a given in our line of work, for both of us. It's not a risk-free occupation. Most likely she's on her way to one of the less well-equipped countries. The UK has an unusually large and proficient OxInt service to help disinfect an ulcer in the skin of reality. There will be plenty of backup and support, but she's still going to have to do heartbreaking things to people who probably don't understand why the pale woman with the bone-white violin and blood dripping from her fingertips is coming for them. Innocent bystanders, collateral damage, victims the monsters just haven't gotten around to eating yet, and the monsters themselves. She has to deal with them all. And here she is, shivering naked in the kitchen at dead of night, and not just with the cold. When it's over, I want to schedule some quality time. A vacation, somewhere safe. A spa weekend, maybe. Would you like that?
Yes, Bob.
I hear her, but her heart isn't in it. She's gazing inwards again, already thinking herself into the frame she's got to be in to do her job properly.
We can talk about it when I get back.
I let my arms drop and she steps backwards, away from me, closer to the kitchen table, so that her left hand is within reach of the violin case. It's instinctive. She always does that. Like a hit man ensuring he knows where his pistol is, so that he can reach it without thinking, using muscle memory in the dark.
I'd better go and get dressed. Are you going to stay up?
I nod. I'll see you off. It's not as if I'll be able to get back to sleep again. Once Mo's taxi comes to whisk her away, there doesn't seem to be much point in sitting around the house brooding. Everything here serves to remind me of her absence, like a jaw from which a tooth has unexpectedly disappeared. So I force myself to make some breakfast, eat it in silence. It's too early for the Today programme on Radio 4, my usual breakfast time distraction, and I leave for the office around the time Mo's flight is pushing back for departure. Dawn is breaking as I reach the front door and let myself in. I go straight to my office, fire off a couple of terse, ill-tempered emails to various people, by way of pissing on the fire hydrant to let them know that I'm on the job even earlier than they are, and head to the coffee station for the first in-flight refueling of what promises to be a very long day. Pete, bless his cotton socks, is either running late or has wangled a day off for pastoral duties. Consequently, I'm on my own in the office when Andy knocks on my door around 10 o'clock. Obviously, he's gotten the memo I sent out at O Dark O'Clock. I let him in. "So, what do you think?" I ask expectantly. Andy lowers himself gingerly into the guest chair and puts his feet up on the stack of dysfunctional laptops.
"About your proposed methodology?"
"That, and the targets." He purses his lips and inflates his cheeks like a gerbil, then allows the whistling exhalation to escape.
"Let's see. Silver nitrate in styptic pencils, allergic reactions to. Hirsutism, anemia and photophobia, a bunch of synonyms you dug out of a medical thesaurus. And you expect to find something?"
"I don't expect, Andy, but it'd be good to eliminate the obvious, wouldn't it? It's sound protocol to ensure we're not getting false positives, and it will hopefully conceal what we're really looking for."
"Which I was just getting to."
"Kreutzberg syndrome."
"Yes, that."
He looks doubtful.
"You think you can find it in the population at large?"
Kreutzberg syndrome haunts me, because it's a personal bête noire. Magic is a side effect of certain classes of mathematics, notably theorem proving. Sensible magicians, like me, use computers. But if you're smart and agile, you can perform some types of invocation in your head. The trouble is, just as our symbol-manipulating machines attract the attention of extra-dimensional agencies, demons, you might say, so do such DIY invocations. If you perform ritual magic regularly, some of the things you invoke will chew microscopic holes in your grey matter. At first, it's not too bad. But the dizziness, numbness, and tingling in the periphery, memory problems, and lack of coordination are irreversible. and frequently progressive. The end result, Kranzberg syndrome, bears a rather unpleasant resemblance to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, not to mention that other happy-fun prion disease, Kuru, which you can only contract by eating the brains of someone who had the condition. Kranzberg syndrome is what people like me die of if the monsters don't get us first. There's a blood test for new variant CJD, mad cow disease to you, so what I'm going to look for is cases of CJD diagnosed at post-mortem that test negative for NV-CJD. Testing CJD cases for NV-CJD is routine and gets reported to the core data service as part of the program for tracking mad cow disease. I'm going to see if I can pull out a geographical plot, I explain. What do you expect it to tell you? Andy leans forward. It's too early to tell. For all I know, I'm going to draw a negative. Actually, I hope to draw a negative. Finding a Kranzberg syndrome hotspot in the community wouldn't be good. This is an understatement, to say the least. Depending on how big a hotspot and where it was located, it could range in severity from a rain of boiling frogs to the end of the world. File under apocalypses and just hope it doesn't happen. It's got to be done. The vampire-werewolf cross-check is just a control, really. Which is what Mo latched onto a month ago and wouldn't let me finish explaining, dammit. How long do you think it'll take to get results? He asks. Ah, well, that's a good question. I smirk unashamedly and fondle the shiny new smart card reader next to my keyboard. Shall we see? What, here and now? When else? I start mousing around. Now pay attention. The NHS Central Data Warehouse is one of those hideous, sprawling IT projects that aren't cleared for takeoff until the stack of documentation exceeds the height of the Eiffel Tower. It stores tens of millions of patient records, hopefully in something resembling a valid XML schema, in a monstrous distributed database. There's a hideously ugly Windows application called the Standard Extract Mart, which theoretically lets you run searches and pull reports out of the warehouse. In practice, it's sluggish, and if you want to work on data covering more than about 1 month, you're supposed to phone Mr. Jobsworth at BT and whine for help. And if you go dumpster diving for cabinet ministers or rock stars, you can expect the boys in blue to come knocking at your door toot sweet. But we are the laundry. We have almost as L33T hacking skills as GCHQ. We also have access to some other data warehouses that I'm not allowed to talk about, even in classified internal documents such as this memoir. Although if I mumble unpronounceable acronyms like CESG and GCHQ and MTI/CCDP and recommend that you speculate along such lines, you probably wouldn't be too far off the mark. This particular database is run by a small and highly specialized group called the Home Office Demographic Profiling Group, which is sort of the 21st century descendant of those 19th century criminologists who thought you could infer the likelihood of someone's descent into criminality by measuring the bumps on their skull. HODPG do not explicitly share their jealously guarded extracts of the SUS database with us, but they do make their source code repository available to other arms of the government, and I am more than happy to borrow the computer-assisted phrenology department's data mining toolkit and point it at the NHS data warehouse using my own login credentials, which, as far as the NHS are concerned, belong to a very peculiar GP surgery inside a silver-roofed toroidal office building in Cheltenham, whose inhabitants are allowed to snoop around the nation's medical records at will without any questions being asked, just in case spying turns out to be a notifiable disease. It's taken me a few weeks to get the appropriate authorizations, and another few days to draw up the search queries I'm going to run. But now I've got an audience, I can bash out a theatrical-looking arpeggio on the keyboard, grin maniacally at Andy and say, "This is going to take a few minutes. How about we get some coffee?" Because I always grin like a loon when I'm wired on legal stimulants. I don't see why not. 10 minutes later, when we get back to my office, I find a new piece of email waiting in my inbox. It's from a software bot, and it has an attachment, about 36 megabytes of Excel data. It's formatted for a 2 versions obsolete version of the spreadsheet that has known bugs, and everybody is trying to move on from, except that it has a couple of 100 million users going back nearly 10 years. Consequently, it's the file format from hell that refuses to die.
Okay, let's see what we can pull out of this, I say, and instead of firing up Microsoft Office, I save the spreadsheet and feed it into a hairball of Python scripts I kludge together, because my programming skills are as obsolescent as Andy's, but a generation more recent.
What are you looking for?
Severe early-onset dementias, sudden strokes, neurological stuff with or without hallucinations. We really need a doctor on the case.
I hesitate to suggest any of the staff from St. Hilda's to help us work out what questions we should be asking. But for now, I've got this dump of everything that's happened in the Greater London area in the past 3 months, and a script to suck it all into a bunch of MySQL tables. The patient data is supposed to be anonymized, but I pulled in their postcode so we can localize them to within about 100 meters, pivoted the results on our Criminal Records Bureau and National Insurance Database mirrors to get the place of work for everyone who's on the books, and the preprocessor is turning that into grid reference data, so we can plot them on a map or query for areas where the rate of... That's funny.
What's funny?
Andy stands up and tries to squint at the monitor. A good trick if he can manage it, given that I've got a privacy filter clipped to the front. I'm not paying attention to his contortions, though. There's something wrong with the data. Or I messed up the postcode to grid location mapping. This can't be right. I scroll back through the log file I had my script barf up in a terminal window. CJD and its cousin NVCJD, the cause of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, a.k.a. mad cow disease, is pretty rare. The UK, despite its positively suicidal attempt at ignoring the epidemic in the early 90s, still only generates about 2 cases per million people per year. The whole Greater London area, with 15 million souls in its catchment area, should show about 30 cases a year, or 2 to 3 a month. And indeed, 3 months ago there were 2 cases. 2 months ago there was 1 case. But in the most recent month for which I have data, last month, I'm seeing 12.
What am I looking at? Andy demands.
This. I turn the monitor towards him, then pull off the privacy screen. CJD detected at autopsy, a 400% spike last month.
You know what? This has got to be a coincidence. Or a case of creeping data corruption. If the rate of CJD had rocketed like that earlier in the year, we'd have been reading about it in the newspapers. There'd be questions in Parliament. In fact,
I hit up the map view.
Oh. Oh, dear.
A rash of red spots flicker across the map of London like a bad case of chickenpox.
That's indexed by home address.
But we can also look at their medical practice or their place of work, see if anything jumps out at us.
Oh. Oh, shit.
All but 8 of the red spots vanish when I filter by workplace, but one of them is much, much bigger, flashing malignant crimson. They all work for the same employer.
Andy stares at the screen.
That's odd. Where is it?
Let me check. It's an office cleaning agency in the East End. I frown. 12 cases in 1 month.
Another 7 outside it, sprinkled across the rest of London.
That tears it, doesn't it?
Yes, I should say so.
Andy stares at the screen. He looks worried.
If it was evenly spread over the whole of London, it'd only be a 3 sigma spike, but just in 1 employer in the East End? I think you may be looking at 5 sigmas.
He's thinking what I'm thinking. 10 extra cases in 250,000 people in 1 month corresponds to about 30,000 extra cases a year in the UK as a whole. That's not just a signal in the noise. It'd be fighting it out with lung cancer and heart attacks as a leading cause of death.
You need to pull those patients' records, so we can double-check that it's not a database error. Then, we need to get a neurology consultant on board who's cleared for Kay syndrome, so we can rerun the post-mortem examinations.
He falls silent.
Then what? If we're lucky, it's just mad cow disease going nuclear under us. Or some hideous new epidemic getting started. If not... If it's actually Kay syndrome, the shit hits the fan.
He reaches into his jacket pocket with a slightly shaky hand and pulls out an electronic cigarette case.
Looks like your 10% had just exploded, Bob.
He raises the cigarette to his lips and takes a puff, The tip glows blue. Blue LEDs are the colour of progress, the colour of the 21st century.
Better find out where those cleaners were working, then pull an action plan together. I think you're about to come to the attention of important people.
I am not a medical statistician. I mean, I can sort of follow a chi-squared regression, and I know my standard deviation from my t-test, but I don't do that stuff for a living. Nor am I a medical informatics guy. For all I know, I fucked up big time with my SUS trawl. So, first I swear Andy to silence, with an embargo time limit of 48 hours. Then I write a very anodyne memo that kinda sorta explains what I've been doing, and send it to my HR admin person and all my various managers, tagged as low priority and with a not entirely misleading subject line. Hopefully that means they'll ignore it for a while. Finally, my ass covered, I shut my office door and do a quick change. Clark Kent uses telephone booths to ditch his suit in favour of the Superman underwear. I do it in reverse. These days I keep a set of office drag on a hanger on the back of my door, against those rare occasions when I have to go somewhere and look invisible in a suit-wearing managerial kind of way. Like this afternoon, because I need to visit a hospital and see a man about a brain. The laundry has an institutional aversion to loose ends, and especially to the existence of civilians, who have, through whatever means, become aware of our work. For many years, if you had the misfortune to be a witness to the uncanny, you'd inevitably end up working within the organisation. However, since the 1980s, the efflorescence of computational systems throughout our society has exposed so many people to the fringes of magic. I use the word cautiously in the context of Arthur C. Clarke's famous aphorism, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic," that we simply can't stick them all in an office and have them keep tabs on one another. Nor would it even be a good idea to try. We need people on the outside, in every walk of life, bound to silence by a gesh, but available when we need specialist consultancy, and also able to contact us if they stumble on something inexplicable. Butcher, baker, candlestick maker, also experts in biblical apocrypha and brain lesions. Other people, accidental witnesses who don't understand what they've seen, are bound to silence and then released, subject to monitoring. Or, if their services are no longer required by the admin side of the organisation, and they have no special skills, or are card-carrying members of the awkward squad, they can be bound to silence and allowed to quietly re-enter civilian life. It's only the core staff, practitioners, executives, and agents like me, who have no exit options. I'm on my way out of the office today to visit a Dr. Wills at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, which is part of the sprawling complex of medical institutions around Great Ormond Street. Dr. Wills works with the National Prion Clinic and is part of a research group at University College's Department of Neurodegenerative Diseases, which is a long-winded way of saying that if anyone has spotted the spike and knows what's going on, Dr. Wills is probably your man. Or woman, because all it says in our contact database is Dr. F.P. Wills, UCLH, MRC, Prion Research Unit, cleared per OSA 3. This person is our go-to expert on Kreutzberg syndrome, and I don't even get a recognition mugshot or a potted biography? Great. Let me tell you a bit more about K syndrome, because everything is better with early-onset dementia. Magic, the collection of practices that enables us to mess around with the computational ultrastructure of reality, has been around for thousands of years. We're not entirely sure how it works. One theory holds that computational processes involving observers can influence quantum systems up to the macroscopic level via entanglement. Or, from another angle, we reach out into an infinity of parallel universes and pull rabbits out of the hat. Rabbits with too many tentacles that do what we tell them to do. Either way, thinking or cogitating or reasoning or singing or just plain looking at stuff the wrong way can make things happen in the physical universe. So, yes, magic works, although the do-it-in-your-head variety is notoriously hard to master, like solving three-dimensional cryptic crosswords in multiple languages. But if magic has always worked, Why are successful magicians so rare in the historical record? It turns out that the limiting factor is not just the difficulty of the job, it's the medical side effects. Now for a brief diversion. In the 1950s, Australian medics in Papua New Guinea discovered a perplexing new disease among the women and children of the Four tribe. The victims would be overtaken by a sudden weakness and muscle pains. They'd succumb to violent shivering, lose the ability to stand up, and eventually die. The disease, known as kuru, was infectious, although no actual agent was detected until the 1980s. The Four practiced cannibalism as part of the funeral rites. The bereaved would consume parts of the body of the deceased to return their life force to the community. Men took the choice cuts, muscle from arms and legs. They mostly dodged the bullet. But the women and children ate the leftovers, including the brain. If you examined the brain of a kuru victim through a microscope, you would see odd spongy holes scattered throughout the cerebral cortex, hence the term spongiform encephalopathy. The disease agent in kuru turns out to be a prion, a malformed version of a naturally occurring protein that catalyzes conversion of normal protein molecules into the pathogenic state. It's a truly weird and scary corner of medical research, because the diseases caused by prions, such as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and fatal familial insomnia, kill horribly, first taking the victim's mind and then their ability to move. Not to mention new variant CJD, also known as mad cow disease. Now, back to the subject on hand. Ritual magicians who perform too many invocations in their head tend to develop a package of symptoms after a while which eerily resemble kuru. It starts with tremors, unsteady gait, slurred speech and confusion. Then they become unable to walk, suffer from ataxia and uncontrollable tremors, and show signs of emotional instability. They become depressed, but may suffer from fits of maniacal laughter. In the final stages, they lose all muscular control, can't sit or swallow or speak, become unresponsive to their surroundings. And from start to finish, it can take between 3 months and 3 years. Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome is a horrible way to die. Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome is probably also the only spongiform encephalopathy that is not a prion disease. I say probably because there are relatively few cases of it in the first place, which makes it very hard to investigate. However, prion proteins appear to be absent in K syndrome, and extracts from K syndrome brains don't cause symptoms in other organisms that they've been tested on. For obvious reasons, nobody's been able to perform the most important test on other humans. The best theory to account for K syndrome is that ritual magic is intentionally designed to attract extra-dimensional critters, and not just big ones. There seems to be some variety of microscopically small, dumb eaters that materialize inside the grey matter of the practitioner while they are in the process of carrying out some sort of invocation, take a tiny bite, and disappear again. Brain parasites from beyond space-time, in other words. The brain is a resilient piece of squishware, but if the K parasites chew enough tiny holes in the head meat, its owner will eventually succumb to a dementia-like illness. Furthermore, once the eaters have found a tasty lump of brains to chow down on, they keep at it. So the disease is progressive, vile, and fatal if unchecked. Unchecked? Well, yes. We can stop it progressing by putting the victim inside a locked-down protective ward. This is a huge step forward over, say, kuru or CJD. What's more, if we isolate the patient for long enough, the eaters lose interest and go away. But the victim isn't going to be casting any spells ever again. If they're lucky, they'll still be able to talk coherently and tie their own shoelaces. It's a health and safety nightmare. Especially for me, because when I'm wearing one of my more recently acquired hats, trainee necromancer, I'm all about the jamming with magic in my head thing. My relationship with K syndrome is like that of a 40-a-day smoker with basal cell carcinoma. Not so much a matter of if, as of when. Which is why I am not looking forward to my visit with Dr. Wills. Excuse me, is this the entrance to the Department of Neurodegenerative Disease? I have an appointment in the Prion Research Unit.
Hi, I'm here to see Dr. Wills. How do I get to Dr. Wills's office?
I'm lost in a twisty maze of whitewashed corridors, surrounded by glass-fronted cabinets stuffed full of photocopied notices on every side, not to mention a scattering of conference surplus posters with excessively enlarged cross-sections of gruesomely diseased brains, just for variety. I've been wandering in circles for 10 minutes now, and I'm just beginning to despair of finding my destination. Trish booked me a slot with the doctor for 3:30 p.m., but I'm running a quarter of an hour late. I find myself flagging down an irritated-looking researcher who clearly thinks she has better things to do than give directions to visiting admin people.
"I'm not in," she snaps. "I'm running late for a meeting."
I do a double take. "Are you Dr. Wills?"
"Yes, and I'm running late."
She begins to walk away.
"If it's about the facilities audit, it'll have to wait."
I haul out my warrant card. "I'm not from admin." Wills turns back towards me.
"Hey, I'm supposed to be meeting you in room 2006. What are you doing here?"
"Nobody told me about a meeting room. Where's room 2006?
Over."
She stops.
"Hmm."
She has a way of tilting her head and narrowing her eyes as she assimilates new information that reminds me of Mo. The straw blonde hair and slightly watery eyes behind thick lenses are very different, though.
"Well, as you're here, would you rather use my office?"
I shrug. "If it's private." I put the warrant card away. As I said, nobody mentioned a meeting room.
"Mac, our departmental receptionist, said he'd sorted it out."
"Well, it never got passed on to my end." Yet another detail that fell through the cracks. "Your office isn't shared, is it?"
"Yes, but Barry's teaching today."
She eyes me cautiously.
"Why?"
"What I want to talk about isn't for public consumption, I'm afraid." I shrug self-effacingly, trying to take the sting out of my brusque approach. "I need to pick your brain on the subject of a delicate matter." Dr. Wills's office is surprisingly spacious. It's what we jokingly refer to as an arc special in the laundry. It's actually sized for 2 people, with 2 desks, 2 workstations, 2 of everything. I take the visitor's seat across from her, one that is clearly accustomed to regular visitors, for it is free of clutter and situated in a clear patch of floor. She shuts the door behind us. I appreciate the gesture.
"What can I do for the laundry today?"
she asks. I take a deep breath. "You've worked with us before, I gather. On K syndrome."
"Kranzberg-Gödel spongiform encephalopathy, yes?"
She waits for me to nod.
"That's it. Tell me, for epidemiological purposes, speaking hypothetically..."
I'm making a hash of this. I force myself to get a grip.
"Suppose there was a significant outbreak of K syndrome in the UK. Am I right in thinking that the first thing we'd know about it would be a spike in cases of CJD being diagnosed by post-mortem examination?"
"If there was a..."
Her expression could not be more eloquent if I'd asked her how we'd know if there was a minor outbreak of the Black Death. A mixture of pungent disbelief, the barnyard stench of second-guessery, and a high note of, oh shit, all colliding simultaneously in the back of her mind. It's enough to freeze anyone's tongue. So I give her a few seconds before I grin and nod, trying to look like an idiot student in need of tuition.
"Please tell me you're joking. No? Oh, fuck."
She slumps back in her chair.
"Hang on."
She straightens up again as second and then third thoughts line up in a disorderly queue.
"This isn't a joke, is it?"
"I sincerely hope not. I don't want to waste your time or mine. Look, I know you'd be aware of actual referrals for treatment, patients with active disease and a diagnosis, right?"
"Yes, that's exactly right. So there can't be an epidemic without us knowing about it because..."
She stops dead. "Because it's a progressive disease, and you'd be seeing them as referrals from wherever they were diagnosed?"
"Yes."
She frowns, perplexed.
"Your scenario doesn't make sense, I'm afraid."
"Okay, let me try again. If coroners around the country began recording spongiform lesions in the brain of patients who had died suddenly in the past month, how long would it take you to hear about it?"
"The past month?"
She shakes her head.
"Then it can't be K syndrome, Mr. Howard. We get regular updates from the NHS Epidemiological Tracking Database, part of the Secondary Usage Service. K syndrome is rather distinctive.
Your typical patient exhibits the symptoms of NVCJD. It's a strikingly early onset dementia with non-standard signs and presentation, and it's progressive. More to the point, the patients are also distinctive. Mathematicians, philosophers, occultists. Also, they test negative for PRP variants. What you're talking about is something else, diagnosed only after death, which means the patients went downhill much too rapidly for Case syndrome or any prion disease we know about. Do you have any more information about them?
I finally get to open my briefcase. This is the output of a query I ran on data extracted from the SUS data warehouse. I shoved the screenshot I took of the geographical scatter plot across her desk. 12 cases were diagnosed at post-mortem, all in the past 4 weeks. The factor they've got in common, at least what I've established so far, is that they all worked for an office cleaning agency in Tower Hamlets. I don't have the individual patient records, but I suspect the shit is going to hit the fan really soon, and I'd like to have some answers to send up the line. I shove the printout of the spreadsheet summary at her. Ages, postcodes, other basic anonymized information. Her eyes flicker across the papers.
This is...
It's crazy, isn't it? I suggest.
No, but it's something new. How did you find this?
I hesitate for a couple of seconds. I don't think I can tell you, I finally say. Not without prior authorization.
Well, if it's not Kranzberg-Gödel syndrome, that makes it even worse.
She shakes her head in unconscious distress.
Mr. Howard, I'm going to have to go and do some digging in order to de-anonymize these patients and confirm that what you found actually exists. Data warehouses tend to accumulate rubbish in the corners. I can't just go pulling these records without justification. There are issues of medical confidentiality here, and respect for the relatives and so on. On the other hand, I can't write this off either.
She stares at me until I make eye contact.
I may need some arms discreetly twisted, and unlike you, I don't have one of those special badges.
I make a careful judgment call and decide to exceed my lawful authority. Just this once, in order to facilitate the speedy investigation of a major threat. That's what I'll tell the auditors if they haul me onto the carpet. Doing it by the book, I should go and round up a committee or a herd of managers to agree with me first. Diffusion of responsibility, it's called. But I honestly don't think there's time for that right now. 30,000 deaths a year corresponds to 700 a week. Just sitting on it for the extra day it'd take to convince a committee could result in... Let's not go there. Whose authorization do you need? I ask.
Professor Everett can sign off on the paperwork to pull the patient records, but I'll need to persuade him in turn that the Department of Health are happy about this.
She bites her lip.
K syndrome is a special case, of course, but
This is suspected K syndrome, or a K syndrome-related condition of, what's the right medical term?
Unknown etiology. Yes, that should do it. I need authorization to access medical records of deceased patients suffering from a spongiform encephalopathy of unknown etiology that is possibly associated with K syndrome. In writing. Preferably signed in blood. Can you get me that?
She does the tilt-shift thing again, like she's trying to view me as a miniature diorama. Yes, I'll email you a memo as soon as I get back to my office. Is there anything else?
Yes.
She stands.
Better pray to whatever nameless horrors you believe in that you're wrong, Mr. Howard. If 12 people died of a new sudden-onset form of K syndrome in London in the last month, then you'd better hope it was just a group of cultists who got lucky. Because if it wasn't, we're in worse trouble than you can possibly imagine.